Hello, everybody. Welcome to TYH. My name is Angelo, and with me I have Nikephoros Fokas and a special guest, Eric Stryker. Say hello, guys.
Hey, how you doing, cool. Everyone?
So how's your guys' nice Monday?
Happy President's Day.
Enjoying the memory of the presidents, I suppose.
For all this time, we thought that the president was like the most powerful man in the world, but especially in America. That has been proven false.
Oh, yes.
With the Trump era, Donald Trump has essentially discredited liberal democracy basically by doing nothing. So he was elected to do one or two things, and he's failed to do all of them.
Yeah, all right. He's got him by the balls.
I think it's more of a better to say that liberal democracy discredited itself. If all he had to do was nothing, then I think that's more inherent to the system than to the man.
Yeah. I mean, it's not personal. I don't personally hate Trump for it. You know, I am convinced that this Mueller thing was just another coup. But because America is America and not a third world country, the coup's shadow was enough to make Trump play ball. That's why I just saw now Rod Rosenstein is planning to retire from his position at the Department of Justice in March.
New development.
Yeah, that he's gonna leave. I mean, but the problem is, like, this guy has been, you know, even the mainstream Judenpress has identified him as the coup leader, the guy that was basically instrumental in this Mueller coup. And it baffles me that Trump wouldn't use his powers to bring this man up on sedition charges. You know, if you're inside the government planning to overthrow the duly elected president, that is textbook sedition. Okay.
Yeah.
So I thought he had balls.
Yeah. Well, he's afraid that they're going to put his son in jail. That's what it is. You know, Roger Stone was the warning shot. Remember, this was happening when Trump was refusing to reopen the government. Suddenly, you got this massive FBI SWAT raid on Roger Stone, broadcast live on CNN. That was a message they were sending Trump.
Oh yeah, no doubt. Next. Like, that was absolutely, like, dramatic to an extreme level. I mean, that doesn't happen to anybody in politics.
No.
Like, do you remember the governor of Illinois, Blagojevich?
Yeah.
He didn't have this, like, fucking early dawn raid on his household to bring him up on his corruption charges. No, he went in with the comfort of his lawyer and his limousine and whatever it is that he, had with him. He did not have this whole dog and pony show trial to broadcast to the public of how they're going to throw the book at Blagojevich for his corruption charges.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the additional thing about this is that the what I assume is a Jewish judge, her name is Amy Berman, was appointed by Obama, was the one that waved away the Benghazi case with Hillary. This person is in charge of Roger Stone's future. And she ruled to shut him up because, of course, you know, the FBI, the Mueller probe has unlimited resources. They have the entire media in their pocket. But Roger Stone had a little corner, right? He had InfoWars. He had a friendship with Tucker. He counted on a favor. He got on a show. He was making noise about his unfair prosecution. And this judge basically ordered that he had to shut up because he was, quote, prejudicing the case by giving his own side of the story after CNN broadcast is basically gave him a perp walk right on live television.
Yeah, it's some very crazy stuff indeed.
That is some shit. And in the meantime, we have Trump with his big announcement on Venezuela today. I didn't get a chance to see exactly what he said, but I saw it was like a whole big deal that
something
he
about
was
the
going
death,
on the record
like
about
death
Venezuela.
To socialism, and that's paraphrasing it, but he mentioned socialism basically. And
well, it's funny that he says that because the same on the very same day today, you have an article from the New York Times where the head of the RNC, at least on the campaign committee, is saying that the calling card of the 2020 campaign will be about, among other things, opposition to socialism. So I guess, in effect, we can call instigating a coup in Venezuela to be the formal announcement of candidacy in 2020. This is officially the start of the campaign season, because if the core message is going to be anti-socialism, and we have the anti-socialist justification for intervention in Venezuela, then I can only assume that the two must be related, and we can consider this announcement to be the start of the Trump 2020 campaign.
Well, on his tweet, he says that the Venezuelans are turning the page on socialism and dictatorship, and there will be no going back. All in caps.
Yeah, you know, I wrote an article about this a couple of weeks ago, how every time a GOP president is about to betray a promise to their Gentile voters, they start a mini war. So I made the example of I gave the example of Ronald Reagan, right? He was elected by the evangelical Christians to put in an amendment that protects prayer in school. Yeah. That law was hung up in Congress the whole time. Reagan wasn't planning to actually push it through. And in 1983, he invades Grenada, basically shot there's 20 Cuban guys building an airport in Grenada. And they did this dramatic siege where they shot them all or something. And then they had this big military parade. Then Bush Sr., when he was about to raise taxes, you know, after he ran on not raising taxes, he did Panama. He had, I think it was Noriega. And the media went into this frenzy where they were comparing this, you know, small-scale drug lord who once worked for the CIA and then went rogue or something. They were comparing him to Hitler. And then you had that war. I'm going to guess that they're planning something similar here to scratch the patriotic itch, have the parades, make people forget about the wall and the immigration promises. That's my take on it.
Let's focus on destroying socialism.
That'd be the worst of all possible outcomes. I think it's just a ploy for political capital. I don't think there's an inherent tie to distraction from the real issues within that construct, but you seem to be convinced that they are just trying to downplay the wall issue or other core red meat with this. What makes you think that?
Well, I just saw the GOP unveiled its 2020 election strategy, and their election strategy is to call the Democrats anti-Semites and socialists. Oh. Nothing about immigration, nothing about...
Shoot, I want to be Democrat now.
Yeah. Well, my thing is that, you know, kiss the Rust Belt goodbye.
I know.
Kiss the alt-right vote goodbye. Because without those two factors, you're not going to win in 2020. So I'm just going to take that as them. The fact that they're running McCain-Palin 08... all over again. I mean, that's what John McCain ran on. He ran on calling Obama a socialist and got destroyed. People would rather vote for a fucking black guy than go with the GOP. I mean, there's racist people in the Midwest that voted for Obama because of how bad the GOP was.
So, yeah. Now, let's say we find ourselves in a situation where Trump is able to, at a bare minimum, retain his voter base from 2016 with this platform, and he wins re-election on the McCain 08 message. What do we do from there in terms of our outreach and messaging towards the public, knowing that this is what, you know, Republicans will still go for, even if it's different from 2016? Like, imagine he's able to convince the Rust Belt that they've finally turned the ship around, and that if they want to keep going on this new course towards economic recovery, that they need to vote for Trump in 2020 again, and it works, and it's also sold on the bill of anti-Semitism and anti-socialism. What do we do at that point?
I think it would be just like, I think Trump's second presidency will be just like Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio becoming president. I think that is when people are going to stop having faith in affecting anything in Washington. So I think that the messaging there is to come up with a new alternative. I think there's a big audience out there. Remember, a lot of people that voted for Trump in the red states also voted for Bernie in the primary. So that is something. I mean, personally, I don't think it's even possible if they run on that stupid platform, unless the Democrat is so bad. And when I say bad, I'm not talking about radical. When I say bad, I mean like they run Kamala Harris or Beto O'Rourke or some other bland, boring person like that. Yeah. If that were to happen, Trump has a chance. But ultimately, the margin of victory Trump had in 2016 would not have been possible without the coalition he built. He didn't build a coalition of, you know, neocons and, you know, people like that and libertarians and people like that. No, Trump built a coalition of industrial workers, of unemployed people, of, you know, with a populist economic message. I mean, whatever happened to closing the carried interest loophole, right? Nothing in sight with that. So he ran on basically an anti-establishment, anti-Wall Street, anti-globalist platform. That's what he won on. And if he's going to change his tune and run a Ronald Reagan circa 1984 fighting AIDS and communism platform, who the fuck is that going to resonate with?
Well, it resonate with Jacob Vull.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, the only people I see that like Trump's new direction are paid shills like Charlie Kirk. Brilliant. Right. Trump's new direction is brilliant.
Yeah, I actually saw
perfect
a guy.
10D chess.
I actually saw a guy with a Turning Point USA pin on his backpack.
Really?
Yeah, it's like, whoa, I didn't know I would see this IRL.
Yeah, those people are paid. That's total AstroTurf. That's paid by the same cucks and neocons that brought us Paul Ryan. Charlie Kirk is like the future Paul Ryan. The problem is there's no more audience for that. Like there was way more of an audience for that when John McCain and then Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan ran. There was a way bigger audience for that shit. There's no audience for that now. That's all gone. So who are they going to appeal to with that bullshit? Like there's like no one's going to vote for it. People are just going to stay home. Yeah. And that is going, I think I already said this before. I don't think Trump wants to be president anymore. I think he just wants to go home and retire. and this is basically him giving in to letting the consultants in the GOP have their last day and make their money. And then everyone goes home. You know, I think that's all they want right now.
Well, speaking of the lack of appeal that kind of, I guess, ideology has to people, for sure within the younger generations there's been a rejection of like free market worship and capitalism.
Yeah,
I think we'll have a lot of people going to the alt-right who have never been libertarians before, which is interesting because for a while it was the libertarian pipeline, but I think a lot of kids are just they're very apathetic with regard to capitalism. It's I don't really see anyone my age and younger like capitalism, yay, besides a few like paid shills like Charlie Kirk or something.
And that's kind of what they're struggling with right now. They're trying to make it catch again and they're not going to. See what's going on is that the left and right of today is radically different from the left and right of 10 years ago. Part of that is due to the internet. People have engaged with different ideas, and when you do engage with different ideas, suddenly classical liberalism and conservatism seem just like idiotic, right?
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
You know, if you're in a situation like I just saw, I mean, it's not just us, you know, with us, we kind of know the score, but you know, I think what people in the more conservative spectrum are dealing with, like I just saw today, a guy that's a Proud Boy lost his Chase account.
Yeah.
And this guy, I mean, they literally have we're entrepreneurs and fight for the free market. That's like literally in their constitutional manifesto and shit. So like these guys are getting letters in the mail saying, nope, you can't have banking services anymore because you aren't even that radical. You're just a little too radical. You're too anti-communist. You're too,
Is this the mulatto guy?
Patriotic. Yeah, that guy. But there's another guy, William James, and he does American Guard, I think. A very anti-communist group. They're not racist, but they're very anti-communist. They're kind of alt-light-ish.
Yeah.
And he got a letter in the mail saying, okay, you're not allowed. You just lost your Chase bank account. And then another guy, Joe Biggs from InfoWars, who's a real fucking patriotard. He's like all like there's a t-shirt on his webpage for sale. It has a picture of George Washington and it says, I didn't beg or plead for my rights. I shot motherfuckers. Like, is that he's like the gun show rootin' tootin' type.
Yeah.
And he lost his fucking banking services. So this is clear. Like, you know, even if Trump ran the election he did in 2016, the government and the capitalists and the media are all taking steps to make sure that anyone who helped get him elected in 2016 is permanently silenced. That's why InfoWars got deplatformed. That's why the Proud Boys are being pushed underground by the FBI. That's why there's this big campaign to dox even. I saw they dox some guy. He has a Twitter account. There's no proof he even ever went to any rallies or did anything. He just had a Twitter account where he once made fun of Heather Heyer. And these scumbags, these scumbags financed by Wall Street Jews, they went and they doxed this guy. They posted a picture of they posted a link of his of the Pee Wee soccer team he fucking coaches. Whoa. So guess what? Well, I mean, what's that for, right? You're putting that out there so crazy people can go and hurt him and the kids that he coaches. That's why you're putting that out there. We all know that's why you're putting that out there. And these people claim different.
I did not know about that. That's really, really screwed, man. That's really screwy.
Yeah. So this is the system lashing out. I mean, it's increasingly difficult to practice your First Amendment rights in America. Another guy, you know, another thing I'm starting to notice is that literally anyone, I'm talking about podcasters. I'm not even talking about people that do real life political organizing. I'm talking about writers, bloggers, podcasters. They're getting fucking knocks from the FBI to their house. Okay. Yeah. That's, I mean, the FBI, from what they say, the FBI comes up to them like, hey, listen, I know you're not doing anything illegal. Fine. Let's cut it off right there. Why are you at my house then? If I'm not doing anything illegal. And they say, well, listen, we respect your First Amendment rights, but we just want to warn you that you're on the line. And you know what is that? Well, that's to shut you up.
Yeah.
I mean, I was reading in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz how all these Antifa activists and SPLC people and ADL people, they were commenting on their strategy for silencing nationalist dissent. And their strategy, they said it. It's not me saying it. It's them. They said it straight up. They said, there's three prongs. There's three legs on this stool. The first one is doxing. You put people's information out there so that they lose their ability to work. The anarchist paramilitary groups come after them. People attack their families and so on and so on. So there's that. That's the first line. Then if they don't shut up, the second line is civil lawsuits. Like, I don't know if you guys knew this before. I sure didn't. Apparently, if 10 extremely powerful Jew lawyers get together, they can violate your Fourth Amendment rights without any probable cause. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. So that civil lawsuits is the second one. And the third is also shoddy criminal prosecution. And what they mention in that realm is that most nationalists are, they can't raise money for good lawyers because guess what? They're deplatforming you too. So if you put out a call, hey, I need money for my lawyers. I have these people filing the slap lawsuit against me, or I have this really ridiculous fake charges to fight. You can't get money for it because the ADL and the SPLC have effectively denied you banking services and the ability to raise money for lawyers. So they were talking, they're bragging about all this stuff as the method with which they silence people. Now, to add to that, I'm actually going to write an article about this. I just saw a four-hour, or rather a four-part documentary that was created by Al Jazeera. It's an undercover investigation of AIPAC and the Israel lobby.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
And it came out, it was supposed to come out late last year, but the Qatari government actually didn't release it out of fear that the Jews of America would get the Saudi government to invade them. Because I don't know if you're following that, but last year the Qataris were being attacked by Saudi Arabia and various other Gulf Arab nations for their ties to Iran, and they were being blockaded and sanctioned by these other countries in the region. So they made this documentary, and they were afraid to release it because they knew that if they did, the Saudis would immediately invade. So anyway, this documentary got leaked.
Holy shit, man.
Yeah, so this documentary got leaked to a Palestinian activist anyway, and they uploaded it. And the stuff I recommend absolutely everyone watches and download a copy of it, because it's a matter of time until they take it offline. What do you see in there? So it's actually a guy who's like part Jewish and he speaks Yiddish, so they immediately trust him, right?
Yeah.
But this guy, he's got a hidden camera, so he's meeting all these big wigs in the Jewish lobby in Washington, and you know, all these Jewish campus groups and Israeli you know, special interest groups and such. And he's talking to them in private, and they actually brag about their strategy on how they shut people up. So in one case, there was a woman who was essentially implying that after the Jewish students lost a BDS vote on the University of California Davis campus, they actually she was implying that they painted a swastika on their dorm room door, and that thing was found at 10 a.m. and the media was there at 11 a.m. So they had like advance notice about this phony swastika. They did that before, and then they went on this meeting.
Oh my god, are you kidding me?
Yeah, it's all on hidden tape. She was basically winking and nodding. Swastika. She was like, oh well, you know, like the day after this vote happened, you know, someone painted a swastika on the Jewish students' dorm room. Very interesting. Someone painted a swastika. No one's ever been caught for it. But the media was there, and it was a very bad look for the BDS students. Another case is where they brag about there was a professor that was leading a BDS campaign. Mm-hmm. And so they hired a bunch of anonymous trolls to put up fake sexual harassment allegations about him on the internet. And this guy was bragging, like basically saying, yeah, we want his wife to divorce him. We were trying to get his wife to divorce him so that, you know, if you're busy with your personal problems, you don't have any time to criticize Israel. That's what they're fucking saying.
Jeez.
And another one, there was a Palestinian or an Arab woman that was leading a BDS campaign on her campus. They told the FBI, well, basically they created a campaign labeling her as a terrorist. And then the FBI came and started questioning her and started harassing her in real life. So these are tactics that Jews use on all of their opponents, whether it's BDS, whether it's people that you know, affirm white dignity and fight against white genocide, whether it's critics of war, whether it's critics of plutocracy, critics of finance capitalism. Anyone that gets in their way is subjected to the exact same tactics, okay? And that's what is so important about this, because it's not a conspiracy theory. You actually see them admitting to it on hidden camera. It's fucking insane. There's another one where he says, yeah, this guy, he works for AIPAC, and he goes like, yeah, we have a direct line to the Washington Post. Anything that we want them to write, they will write for us. And then when the Al Jazeera asked the Washington Post about it, they acted all outraged and shit. But like, these kids were admitting this shit.
You know, it's nothing we didn't already know, to be honest. I mean, come on. We people like us, we already knew. But I'm glad this is getting out there for the consumption of the general populace, to the extent that, you know, Gen Pop consumes Al Jazeera, which
Not even Al Jazeera. It's a documentary Al Jazeera refused to air. But I will say this, even though we all know this is what they do and we all suspected it, we never had hard proof. Because, you know, if you don't have hard proof with these things, like anything you want to prove, anytime you want to prove Jewish guilt in something, you have to add about 10 layers of hard evidence that you wouldn't need otherwise, because they're just going to outright reject it as a conspiracy theory, right? But here we have these people on tape talking about this shit, talking about how they dox people in order to terrorize them. And then the same Jew is like, oh, and don't worry about yourself, because they don't have the money or the time to dox us. So we're okay. We can just do it to them all we want. He was basically fucking saying that.
It's a big Goliath to go up against, and that Goliath produces content such as that you see on the website Campus Reform, where you know they purport to be a right wing and conservative outlet on reporting on the news on college campuses, and admittedly one we go to quite often for fresh content about what's going on this current state of American academia. But also, they are beholden to the interests of Zion. One such story put out recently is a good highlight of this, which is titled, "Why is Socialism So Appealing to College Students? Campus Reform's Cabo Phillips has a theory." Basically, this Phillips character goes on to Fox News to discuss this question and gives the answer that it has a lot to do with how it's being sold as compassionate. Many young people view these ideas as free everything, not as unrealistic, but as something that is helpful, that is helping people. Sadly, I think it stems from a lack of history and a lack of realization of what socialism has actually done throughout history. Also, I think it's important to remember that these elements of the far left Democratic Party, these more socialist elements, are no longer a fringe on the left. Maybe it's easy to view them as something to laugh off, but this is a serious issue now. We have legitimate people now, Cory Booker, Elizabeth Warren, and Kamala Harris, all endorsing these things, legitimate 2020 candidates. These are no longer issues, these socialist policies that are on the fringe. They are in the mainstream of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I mean, Campus Reform, I've yet to see Campus Reform write anything about all the pro-white students that have been punished for putting up flyers. So that's the first thing. Campus Reform is also very active in attacking the boycott divestment movement against Israel. So that's another thing.
That's very true.
The third thing about this cuckold organization that will never, ever risk anything to protect any real civil liberties, by the way, this cuckold organization is, again, they're not talking to anyone. I mean, let's talk about it objectively, right? So if you're a middle-class American, you're losing half of your paycheck every week anyway, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The only thing socialism, like if we had actual socialism, the only thing that would happen is that, let's say you have a social democratic system like in England or in France or something. Well, you would get taxed about the same rate, but you get things in return. Yeah, like if you were to actually look at how much people spend on healthcare every month, how much they spend on university educations every month, you'll realize that we actually pay a shit ton more for basic social services compared to other people in the industrialized world. Like, America has the lowest labor union participation of any industrialized country in the world. And even that, most of the labor unions in America are public sector unions. So it's just people that are just taking more money.
It's ass backwards. It's totally ass backwards. We have the strongest unions in this country whose primary objective is to acquire more resources from the entire tax base as a whole versus the alternative of private sector unions, which would just get more from the capitalist class as a whole. And we just accept this as norm. And as a matter of fact, some of the less informed of us buy into this Republican conservative narrative that the unions are our enemy and that we should pass right-to-work laws to combat the teachers' union and the public service sector unions, when in fact those only hurt private sector unions the most, which are the most problematic, but also the companies behind them are the ones that give money to conservatives.
Exactly.
So there's this huge conflict of interest here that doesn't get discussed, and there's just clouded by the the bullshit of things like public school teachers unions, which all of us hate on this show. I'm sure all of us despise these sick people. They will cover for pedophile teachers who molest their children in the most horrific ways. I've seen this in the news like throughout my life. These teachers who will just be put on paid leave thanks to these public school unions. And they've been accused of the most horrific things with photographic evidence. So at that point, you're not talking about accusations. You're talking about proved things. Like, you know, you don't have pictures of your students with, like, you know, insects on the genitalia of their students and be like, well, that's an accusation. No.
When it comes to the American Federation of Teachers, that's run by the Jew. The president is the Jew Randy Weingarten, who's a Zionist and a faggot.
Huh. And, Of course.
Yeah, she went to Yeshiva University just to get an idea, and so the problem with conservatives is that, like, you know, the problem here isn't the teachers' union. Like, I do think teachers deserve some labor protections and decent pay. The problem here is the corruption of an institution by a Jew, and, you know, I mean, because if you want to, you know, basically every institution in America has been corrupted, whether it's labor unions, but also even like as things, of course, the Supreme Court has been totally corrupted.
Religion.
The U.S. government, the Congress. I mean, again, in that documentary, they were showing how these Jewish lobbyists, they basically are talking amongst themselves on hidden camera. And they're saying there's no way to get Congress to do anything unless you give them money in an envelope. So let's give them $200,000 to vote for this or that bill.
Give Jerry Falwell a jet plane and destroy Christianity.
Exactly. Christian Zionism was essentially created by Jews bribing Jerry Falwell. bought him. The government of Israel bought him his own private jet plane. Yeah.
If you see the latest narrative on that, the left side of the Kosher sandwich acts like as if the Christian Zionists were this unwarranted and unasked for constituency that just they only want to convert us. That's the only reason why they support Zionism, and not because we gave them millions of dollars to lobby on our behalfs and form an entire voting bloc to support the Zionist candidates.
Jacob Bull did that talking point when he interviewed, or Mike Enoch interviewed him. That was
Jacob Vole's also like off message when it comes to the Jewish stuff.
The new hot take from him is that he was saying it's the Catholics. The Catholics are behind the immigrant problem. It's not the Jews.
Yeah. Yeah, because, you know, the thing is, I mean, can't you guys see? I mean, Catholics and evangelicals get everything they want when it comes to abortion, prayer in school. Right, I mean, this is the real power structure, you know?
That's why I can't go downtown and, like, bring my girlfriend to Planned Parenthood for them to rip the fetus of our child out of her womb on demand for no cost at all. That's why that's impossible. That's why I can't do that now.
Yeah, just look at how the evangelical and Catholic lobby, how they blocked gay marriage. Wasn't that amazing?
Oh, yeah.
Incredible.
Right. The Supreme Court just filled with Catholics, extreme radical Catholics. Yeah. Like Antonin Scalia, who put the kibosh single-handedly on gay marriage with his, you know, extremely persuading opposition to the plaintiff in that case. He just completely destroyed them, you know, all on his own. And that's why we don't have gay marriage legal in this country, because Catholics, it's the Catholics.
That's right. And remember, look at how they kept pornography illegal. Wow. Oh, and sex ed in school. Remember when they tried to get that in school and the evangelicals showed up with their crosses?
I've never even heard of a condom. I only know abstinence works.
They were able to pray them away. Oh, because they're so scary. That's right. That's where the Israel agenda comes from. That's where the immigration agenda comes from. It's from Catholics and evangelicals.
Zionists.
That's like a peanut brain Noam Chomsky narrative, like always trying to blame evangelicals today are at best. First of all, there's a lot less of them.
Yeah.
And yet the Zionist lobby has gotten stronger. Second, their Christian Zionism is actually like it's all like this superstitious nonsense. Mm-hmm. Like it's not like they go out of their way to lobby for it. It's just like they teach that shit as their theology. It's not like they have they're spending billions of dollars. I mean, none of the top donors to either the Democrats or the Republicans is Christian. They're all Jews. Chaim Sabin, Tom Steyer, Michael Bloomberg, George Soros, Sheldon Adelson. I mean, Sheldon Adelson is actually in this documentary as one of the big financiers of some of this shit. So, like, you know, when you see all these people are the top donors of both parties, and then you're going to tell me that you know some fucking Baptists that can barely read is responsible for U.S. foreign policy. Like, you know, you got to be kidding me. Who believes that crap anymore?
You know, I heard some interesting news that that the same Michael Bloomberg, who's been put out there as the is sort of in the same vein as Howard Schultz as a third party challenge to Donald Trump and the extreme left Democrats. It recently advocated for the establishment of a private police system at his alma mater of the Johns Hopkins University.
Yeah. Really? He established one for the school?
He's advocating on behalf of its creation in recognition by the state that they the same way that other universities have like their own police force, that Johns Hopkins University now creates a private police force that you know, their jurisdiction is their campus, but you know that is the absolute state of liberalism, neoliberalism today, is that your Jewish billionaire donor is going to, like, you know, fund the unlimited integration and open border policy of immigration into your country from the global south, but will also, like, institute private police forces to crack down upon them once they get out of hand. How do you like that? You get the diversity and the police state all in one yeah. Jewish
things I love.
One Jewish lobby.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with America is that America gets it all wrong. It's like a perfect fusion of anarcho-capitalism and Stalinism. That's what Enoch was saying.
Yeah, I just saw that tweet.
Stalinism without any of the good stuff like Prokofiev or classical music subsidized by the government. But then you also have all the bad stuff of anarchism and capitalism without any of the good stuff, like, you know, being left alone when you're just practicing your free speech or assembly. You know, like, there's none of that. America is literally a fusion of the worst fucking the mechanically separated chicken of a country. It's that fucking pink goo. It's that disgusting pink goo. And the country that they're taking us to, these ascendant Jewish forces, these SJW types, Tumblr types, these people are the next generation of leaders. You know, if you think Nancy Pelosi is bad, if you think Kevin McCarthy is bad, wait until some of these boomers fucking start. Some of these system hacks that are being brought up on the left, wait until they start gaining power. Okay. I don't want to live in that country.
Yeah, no, me neither. You know, speaking of the boomers, I just encountered an interesting interaction on intergenerational Facebook group, you know, local liberals that are a part of it. And the question of Israel happened to come up, and I was surprised, but happily so, to see this one boomer, who's a self-avowed liberal, posit the claim that, you know, that he said after he found out what the Jews did to Christ long ago, that it's no surprise to him to see what they do to the Palestinians today. And I'm like, wow, liberal boomers, you know, coming up on the strong anti-Israel position, not the weak. Right. You know, oh, it's bad because they're oppressive. No, it's bad because they're Christ-killing kikes. Yeah, that was surprising. I've never seen a boomer take like that before, especially from liberals.
I'll tell you what, old school leftists, like, you know, the main foreign policy, the consistent foreign policy issue on the left was always Palestine, right? But for the new, you know, digital media trained lapdogs, the anarcho-communists, the Antifa types, for them, it's Rojava or Rojava, however you say that. So I was reading an article in the New York Times where they were saying that basically anarcho-communists were begging the U.S. military to stay in Syria because they need them to protect their LARPy commune there.
Jesus Christ. Give me a break, man. Like, I'm looking at these left comms, these anarchists, and I'm like, shit or get off the Kropotkin.
Yeah, that's a good one.
You know, these people, like, they come out and put out their message like, oh, we support the women's revolution in Rojava. And I'm like, this is bullshit, man. If you know anything about Kurds, they are I have my personal biases, but to me, they are just the underside of the Turk roach. They are the same side of the... They are the opposite side of the same roach.
They're actually,
one side you got Turks, and the other side you got Kurds. And
well, they're actually genetically, they did a DNA test. They said Kurds are actually the closest to Jews of all the Middle Eastern races. So
imagine
that's,
my shock.
And you know, notice though, when it comes to the Rojava thing, what's that replacing? Like, what don't you hear about anymore? You don't hear about Palestinians or Palestinian rights anymore. Like the entire all sides of Gaza is wall now, and they're starving them, they're cutting their, you know, there's like UN aid to them and Israel's withholding it. There's so much crazy shit they're doing to the Palestinians right now, and no leftist will say anything. In fact, very few leftists are even saying anything about Venezuela. You'd think they wanted that this would be the perfect issue. They defend a socialist third world country from American imperialism led by Donald Trump. And yet none of them are marching for that. Instead, what they're doing, the Antifa are going out marching against Trump's non-existent wall. They're going to do that. And it's got no popular support. No one is retweeting them, but they're planning this like big rally. I think it's tomorrow or the day after. It's a big rally where they're going to protest the wall that's never going to happen, which is so they'd rather do that.
The wall despite Venezuelan intervention.
Yeah, exactly. It's really sickening, man. I mean, the good news though is that a lot of principled leftists like Michael Tracy, like Ro Khanna, like Rani Akalik, these are principled anti-war leftists. Two things. One, I think they're starting to see the light as to where the power is. I'm sure you've seen all this stuff going on social media. And two, they're being faced down with censorship. Rani Akalik, who's this like very famous leftist anti-war journalist, she had her Facebook page taken down. She has like a news platform, and that news platform was taken down without any warning, just silenced, just like that, totally censored.
Damn, that's the where they're at this point in terms of enacting a regime of censorship against us. But I think Anglo is having some issues with his mic, and he needs to restart his computer. He's been able to record for the past few minutes, but I think we're going to cut to a break now and continue recording once he's back up.
If you moments later.
We get all the worst parts of capitalism with all the worst parts of communism. That describes America. You get cultural communism and economic capitalism.
Well, at least I get a Funko Pop figure, whatever those things are.
You talking about the one that comes in the Pac-Man cereal?
No, it's Pac-Man cereal. I never heard of that.
I could be getting it wrong. Yeah,
it's those square. They keep them in the boxes. I think you guys may have talked about this before.
Yeah, people keep them in the box. They like to collect these action figures that just have these minimalist facial features, where it's just like everyone has the same shaped head and the same shaped body, but the only difference is the way that they packaged the like accoutrements of the character design. So you got Harry Potter with his like little scar, but his face looks the same. Yeah, I thank God that it wasn't actually something my brother had himself, but I did find a Harry Potter Funko Pop in his room.
Over the, you got
like,
to talk
the other month. Well, I did. I did intervene, actually. Upon seeing it, I'm like, what the fuck is this shit? And he's like, oh, it's a friend gave it to me for Christmas. And I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Well,
that's,
I mean,
that's much better than you buying it yourself. And he's like, yeah, no, I would never buy that myself. And I'm like, let's keep it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I know exactly what you're talking about. And, like, these are just toys, but they're not meant for kids to play with. They're meant for, like, adults to collect.
They're meant for adults. And my brother, he's not a kid anymore either. He's 19 years old now.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, well, my but uncle's into still, that stuff. Somebody
still thought it appropriate to give my 19-year-old brother this toy for Christmas. It's like, what?
Bugman faggot shit.
Yeah.
That's all it is. They should just call it that from now on. Bugman faggot shit. Like, this is what the fuck. I'm looking at this. They got, like, princesses and Pokemon and Superman and Batman. And, I mean, it's just stupid. Like, I mean, this is the problem, you know.
Nice to look at. It's just like a popular brand that they all collect the same thing from, because it's like, I guess the implication is that because it's like Beanie Babies, right? They could make a Beanie Baby that's tangentially related to something you like, and you have to get it because it's Beanie Baby brand and it's something you like. And because it's the intersection of, you know, the mainstream brand of collectible dolls and something you enjoy personally, then you have to get it. But let's just say no, you actually don't have to get it, even though you like this thing. It could come out with a Kodrianu Funko Pop, and I'm not going to buy it.
Yeah, Hitler one.
No, I would buy that, to be honest. No,
yeah. We did talk about the only reason it'd be worth buying in today's world is because it would be like, what the fuck were they thinking when they made this?
I mean,
how did this one slip past Zog?
When I was a kid, at my grandma's house, we had a Millennium Falcon toy from like the 70s or 80s. Then one day, when we were playing with it, my uncle was visiting. He's like, oh, that's my Millennium Falcon. Don't let them play with it.
Oh,
he's like in his 30s or 40s then.
Is that the same uncle that...
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah.
A Millennium Falcon, dude. Come on.
It's a toy.
It's a toy.
It's a fucking toy. I mean, like, this is kind of what they're trying to bring us back to, you know, after Trump, Joe Rogan went from talking about, like, whether, you know, he went from talking about the Lego movie to, like, talking about, like, hard politics with dissidents. Lego. Like, you know, and so, like, that's kind of something they want to stop, you know, because one thing I've learned about liberal democracy is that in order for a system like America to function, America is basically one big crime state. It's just political class is just stealing from the people. You got a capitalist class that steals from the people. So it's just one big corrupt monopoly. But in order for people for that system to continue, it requires the apathy of the public. So the average American man needs to be totally depoliticized, right? Mm. So, you know, you got to be collecting action figures and comic books and listening to Tom Petty and fucking, that's the kind of ideal citizen that is required. Because the reason totalitarian or ideological countries always have problems with their population is because their populations are politicized. Like in the Soviet Union, everyone was expected to be politicized in some way, which creates gulfs and conflicts and issues. But in America, you're able to avoid the dialectic by having, you know, blue ties versus red ties. The blue tie says the red tie is racist. The red tie says the blue tie is an anti-Semite. There's no real dialectic there.
We have our bread and circuses of controlled opposition politics.
Exactly. I wouldn't even honor it with the term breads and circuses. Like, those are probably pretty good.
Yeah, that's
Funko Pops.
Bread and circuses would be better than this.
Yeah.
Shit.
Yeah, like something cool, like a Roman or like a Gladiator arena.
They will gladly Funko let you Pop starve and Call of to Duty. Death and let you starve to death in your pile of Funko Pops. Like, ever let a white family feed itself.
Right. Another thing too is that people had, when people went to the circus in Rome, they brought their kids and their wives with them. In this system, you can bring, like you said, your Funko Pop. Yeah. You can bring your Harley Quinn Funko Pop.
What's or like? your golden retriever.
Oh God, yeah. Well, the animal thing, that's like a whole other, again, that goes back to depoliticization, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you have your needs met as a human being, right? Your need for affection and family and community, if you have those things met artificially, you never miss them when they don't give them to you. So if you don't have if you don't have a wife, you can watch pornography, which is a simulation of having a wife, right? In fact, it's even better because it's like you have a new woman every day.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
If you have, if you don't have children, you get a simulation for a child, which is a cat or a dog.
Like Animal Crossing, the video game, you just basically kind of take after a character and watch it, or like The Sims.
Yeah. I do remember Animal Crossing very vaguely. I never really played it, but I do remember watching like kids playing and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot. I think there's a lot of weird, like fur fags, you know, like furry fandom that comes out of that.
Yeah, the people that actually they have a tail that they it's like a keychain or something. I don't know, and they wear it.
Yeah, it's no. Like a fake if you ever tail. See a nigga man walking on this. Campus with a tail, you just gotta be like, that nigga's fucked up.
Like either you're black or a furry.
Well, I've seen black furries wear this shit on campus, man. It's fucked up. It's like, you must have been bullied so hard as a child for you to get to this point, because you should be some, like, you know, straight ass street nigga, you know, never watched a minute anime in your life, but instead here you are, dude, like doing the Naruto run to class.
Dudes.
Oh, dude. I've been seeing that me and Mike call them the black bugs, black bug. Like those are the weirdest ones of all. Cause you know, when I was growing up, say what you want about blacks, but like, you know, most blacks were like kind of, you know, they wouldn't go near fucking a comic book anything like that. Now I see some of the younger blacks, it's like their testosterone has dropped too. It's like the younger blacks, they were the
coincidence
big,
that everyone's testosterone drops at the same time.
Yeah, they're wearing like the big rim glasses and they're dressed up like a Game Boy and shit. Like I've seen that. Yeah. I think they call them sneakerheads or something. Like they dress like in the 80s stuff, like pastel. Oh.
Sneakers heads are just these, like, you know, these sort of urbanites who fetishize whatever the Air Jordan line of Nike shoes come out. And they, like, I've met these folks. I knew one guy with a collection, I kid you not, this man couldn't have been more than 10 years older than me at the time, and I was still in high school.
Yeah.
And he couldn't have been more than 10 years older than me, and his collection of Air Jordan sneakers was worth $50,000.
Oh,
my God.
This man did not wear these shoes once.
Oh,
He waited in line.
What's the point?
At 3 hours each time.
Like, I collect books, but because
$200
I want to read them.
For a pair of shoes that he would put in his closet and look at, and he would never wear them.
Yeah, like them shoes.
They were his hobby. His hobby was waiting in line to pay $200 of his hard earned money. This guy was not like a rich kid. This guy earned all of his cash through his like bottom wage job.
What a fucking asshole.
And he spent it all on a $50,000 valued collection of tennis shoes.
It's like those dudes that
made in fucking China by Qingquang Li.
Yeah.
Been paid like 2 cents an hour to be whipped.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
sad.
His back scarred and just sweat by the age of six.
There's probably like a note in the tongue of the shoe.
Oh yeah.
That says like, you know, please help me.
Yeah.
Please help.
Well, they'll spend like thousands of dollars on their PC for the newest graphics card.
Yeah, yeah. The nerdy blacks, they're a whole different animal entirely.
It's like you work at GameStop. Blacks,
they'll be like, you know, I'm a furry and I'm going to spend all this money on a gaming PC you know, because I want to be like the best gamer out there. I want to be like the, I want to be a credit to my race by being an epic gamer. Bro,
video games.
What kind of parents did you come from? You must have come from like adopted white parents, because ain't no way no like nigga parents gonna be like, she, you gonna be a professional gamer? I'll whip your ass, boy.
Well, video games are the perfect method of controlling young men, you know, of any race. I mean, usually a society like if you're an oligarch, your number one enemy is young men, especially young men that don't have economic opportunities or wives and kids. So if you're able to create a parallel universe where you can simulate a world where those young men are actually like the king of the king of the castle and the glorious knight or the great warlord, you know, if you're able to simulate a world like that for them, you hit every you ping everything in the brain, the male brain, that causes men to react, and you numb it. So they're living in this fantasy world. It feels like it's real. And that's how like video games have basically retarded a whole, maybe two generations of men at this point. So I don't think that, you know, and of course they're plugging the holes on the margins too, you know, right? Because the guys that don't get into the video games, they'll give them weed. And the guys that don't get into the weed, well, they'll just hit you with like hard jail time or something. I don't know. The point is, though, is that it's truly, like we were saying again for the third time, I'll say it, anarchism plus Stalinism. Okay. You either do what they say, which is like this whole myriad of banal entertainment. There's a lot of it. Sure. There's a plethora of banal entertainment. But if you refuse to do that and you want to be a human and you want to live real life, that is a really dangerous world. So a lot of men that escape into video games do so because the real world is so full of unforeseeable landmines nowadays. You don't know, like, who would have ever thought that you could get suspended from school for, quote, dead naming a tranny? Like, if you were to call a tranny by his real name, you could get suspended from school or banned from social media. You know, if you were to flirt with a girl, you can get accused of sexual harassment or rape. You know, who would have thought? I mean, that's why a lot of these young men escape into porn and video games, because the real world. Exactly.
Like, I mean, years ago, like I was in a situation where I, you know, made some critical post of homosexuals on social media, and I suffered some severe consequences.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, who would have ever thought that, you know, calling someone a faggot could get you in trouble like that? Like, can get you real world ramifications by saying faggot.
That's just how I would talk with my friends, you know. Someone's being a faggot, you just say, hey, you're being a faggot.
Yeah.
And then you can't.
Yeah, I mean, someone dug up Jared Holt's old post from high school where he's, like, calling everyone faggots and queers. Yeah, and, like, exactly. He's calling women sluts. Like,
here it comes. Jared Holt gonna be canceled soon.
Yeah, yeah. No, it also shows you that he doesn't believe his own bullshit. He's just doing this shit for money and kudos.
Yeah, if
we were in charge,
like, this guy is a total asshole. Jared Holt is just a fucking race traitor, little sniveling bitch. He goes out there and tries to get upcomings for all of his stunning and brave posts exposing the Nazis on Twitter.
Well, you know, if we were in charge, Jared Holt would be doing the exact same thing, except he would be outing homosexuals and crypto Jews. Reporting them to us. Like, that's basically what he would be doing, because it's not that he believes in anything. It's a personality type. It's a social climber. It's someone that has no real moral, no internal monologue, no self-starting thought, no moral compass. It's just someone who is born to fulfill the ends of whoever's in charge. It's a perfect slave.
I mean, ultimately, that's correct. He's like just this sycophantic, like you said, social climber. He just wants to get the next dollar for his work, and he knows how to find people on the internet. That's his skill, and the way he applies his trade is to, you know, out people for having the just slightly, you know, non-suicidal political beliefs on the internet.
Yeah, I mean, again, like these people are—they don't have any any self-starting morality. They're totally amoral. They're like the cops, right? Cops are the same way. Like a cop is there to obey orders.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what people like this do. And you know, whatever they might say now, you read what he was saying, you know, no one changes. He wrote those posts when he was like 18 years old. No one changes that radically in opinions in a few years, right? No one goes from calling little kids. I mean, he was a scumbag bully. Like, you know, when I was in high school, I never got the urge to pick on little kids and shit.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, that wasn't.
Maybe you'd fuck with them like in a Big Brother way, but I would never punch a little kid for sitting at my lunch table by mistake or nasty, sadistic shit like that.
Like, you wouldn't do something that results in their whole lives being ruined. Like, they never are employable ever again, in theory.
Yeah, well, I think that my point is, though, is that there's this whole class of people, like, you know, there are people out there who would make excellent journalists. There's people out there that would make excellent movie writers, excellent poets, excellent teachers, excellent historians. But none of them will ever get into these positions because only Jews only allow sycophants to fill these roles. And these sycophants are by nature mediocre people, right? I'm talking about the people that work for BuzzFeed, for Vice, the people that write for that right-wing watch or right-wing extremist watch or the SPLC. Those are mediocre human beings, small-souled. They don't have any spark to them or any desire to change the world for the better. These are just sycophants that take money to grind. They grind. They spy. They deceive and sabotage. They're just rats, literally rats.
I mean, you have a lot of like historical figures in the literary movement who now would be silenced, like even leftists like Jack London, stuff like that.
Yeah. Or how about Pat Buchanan? I was reading Pat Buchanan's book on World War II. I was rereading it the other day. And I'm like, this could never be written. Like, Pat Buchanan got in at a time when you could still like say good things about the Germans and the Italians, as long as you paid lip service to the WASP establishment. Like, oh, you know, Pat Buchanan would say something like, you know, like the theory of Pat Buchanan's book is basically that Britain should have stayed out of the Second World War that Hitler would have triumphed over the Soviet Union, and that would have been good for the white race and Western Christendom. That's essentially what Pat Buchanan argues in the book. And as long as you say good things about the British Empire and the Anglo power structure in America, back in Pat Buchanan's time, you could still have some freedom to engage and operate in Washington, and you'd have a voice and so on. You know, like nothing was funnier than watching Pat Buchanan on MSNBC. Like, they brought him on for a segment where, you know, he was pro-Palestinian, believe it or not. He was anti-Israel and pro-Palestinian. And it was so funny because they were pressing him on why. They're like, hey, you're like this old racist white guy. Why are you pro-Palestinian? And he was like sweating. He didn't know what to say.
The thing is, the man, the poor man has been like on that line for his entire political career. You know what I mean? Like, we all know why Pat Buchanan is pro-Palestinian. And it's been true since he was working on Nixon's campaign back in the day. And he was that influence on Nixon that was in a way contra Kissinger, where, you know, the red pill on Kissinger is that, like, Kissinger probably didn't really care about Israel that much, probably still doesn't care about Israel that much compared to other Jews out there. But, like, still, the suspicion of Kissinger's motives that Nixon expressed on record, that suspicion came from the influence of Pat Buchanan.
Right.
Buchanan always made sure that Nixon never took Kissinger's motives for granted. And probably he should have had even a larger impact if things were to go to work out more optimally, because ultimately Nixon did side with the Israelis hard and set that precedent for administrations to come.
He was trying to save his presidency. They had a
It actually became pretty popular because at the time the Soviets had took the initiative on the question and sided with the Palestinians.
Right.
And that left the only natural option for the Americans to be, well, if the Soviets side with the Palestinians, that means we have to side with the Israelis. And, you know, Kissinger was happy to, you know, promote a foreign policy that was favorable to Israel within the context of American interest, and that American interest being opposition to the Soviet Union. But
I would argue, I would argue that in the 1960s, America and Britain pushed the, you know, before World War II, the foreign policy of Great Britain was Arabist. It was, they put a special priority on their relationship to the Arab world, which is why in the 1930s, the British actually prevented Jews from migrating to Palestine. It was after the Second World War that you had all these shills and plutocrats in charge in America and Britain that they started. For example, there's a, in the 60s, there's a big nonsensical but big campaign against Nasser, the Egyptian leader. Like the British establishment was called, you know, the British were basically giving up access to the Suez Canal just to call Nasser the next Hitler or some shit. Like they're calling the next, because he was an Arab nationalist that hated Jews. So they're basically going after. So there's a long story there, but I take your point that Pat Buchanan to Nixon was a lot like Steve Bannon was to Trump, say.
Right.
Like, that would be a good analogy.
Right.
Not exact, but good.
I think I cut Anglo off with what he was going to go there.
No, I don't. I don't remember what I was going to say.
You were talking about like literary influences or something.
Oh, well, I was going to talk about like, what are you? Are you big into literature, Stryker? Do you?
Yeah, I love literature. Yeah.
Who are your favorite writers?
Oh man. Let's see. I actually like Roald Dahl, even though he's for kids.
Yeah. I love Roald Dahl. He was very based. I know that. He's
He's
said some things about the Jews that we would agree with.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, he
did. What did he say?
He said there's something about the Jewish character that, you know, provokes animosity or something like that. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah, Roald Dahl was pretty hardcore against the. He was, you know, like usually on websites I'll have lists of like the top 10 people you didn't know were anti-Semites, and they'll have like Lindbergh or something. And they also they'll have Roald Dahl on there too.
Fucking based.
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that. I mean, I kind of like what's her face. Jane Austen, you know, Jane Austen.
Oh yeah.
In the English speaking world. Let's see. I mean, I haven't read, if you're talking about fiction, I haven't read fiction in a long time, fortunately. Like I'm just so busy reading like nonfiction stuff that's
my situation too.
Yeah. I mean, I've just lost the taste for it. I can't read stories like that. Like, you know, even though you should read them because these are good, generally solid and good books with good values and such, but I just don't have time for it lately. But yeah.
Yeah, for me, whenever I'm sitting down with a work of literature, I'm just like, I could be reading about the Jews.
But yeah. I could be reading Henry Ford right now.
Exactly. That's,
you know,
really
what's interesting?
Good.
A book I'm reading now that I find very interesting is, I don't know if you guys know Peter Hitchens. Do you know Peter Hitchens?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
He was the brother. I think he's part Jewish, but he's mostly an Aryan. He's mostly British.
No.
Yeah, they're like an eighth Jewish.
Is he Jewish?
Yeah, it's like, whatever, it's distant, but
yeah, it's...
Wow.
Yeah, but he's like the most Anglo man on the planet. Like a real Anglo, not a fucking sold out
he's
Bush.
Like the Anglican Anglo out there.
Yeah. He's not like a George Bush, you know, fucking guy like that. He's like the real deal. But anyway, he is a very interesting guy. I mean, it just shows you how much better British politics are to American politics. So he's considered to be like the most radical conservative in the elite in Britain, in the intellectual elite. But get this, he's very anti-war, always has been. He actually debated with his own brother, Chris Hitchens,
against the Iraq war.
Yeah.
I still like Chris Hitchens, so I remember
that. Yeah, but he was actually a piece of shit. Like, I think Chris Hitchens got all the Jew genes. He took the wrong position on everything.
I hate that guy now.
Well, it's a shame how he ended up before he died, you know. I mean, I can't help but feel bad for Chris, given how his brother was, because, you know, they had the same milieu growing up, and I think...
They're both Trotskyists, you know, at one point, right?
I think
he was a Trot, I think.
I don't know about Peter Hitchens being a Trotskyite.
I know that he at least used to be left. He was
a socialist.
Yeah.
I mean, practically everyone who was a neocon like Chris Hitchens was a Trotskyite. I mean, that's
about Peter.
Right.
I don't know
if he was ever a Trotskyite.
Yeah. Well, Peter is interesting because, you know, we have this weird conservatism in America or whatever. But Peter Hitchens is like the conservative, and in Britain, conservatives are real conservatives, not like these neocon, neoliberal Tories or whatever. But the real old school British conservative is expected to stand by the defense of Western art, Western racial demographics. They're supposed to be anti-war, against pointless interventionism. So Peter Hitchens kind of embodies all of this. And what's fascinating about Hitchens is he has a book that came out last August. And it doesn't go as far as Bat Buchanan, but it is a revisionist book on the Second World War. Basically, it says that Britain has no – that the moral posturing of the British Empire – is all over World War II is all a load of shit.
Like, is that they the have phony that, victory. That,
I'm looking, yes, yes.
Okay, I'm looking at his bio.
The phony victory.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting perspective to take there, Peter.
Yeah, I mean, he pays lip service to the Holocaust, because if not, they just won't publish the book. But
of course,
you can tell from reading it that, you know, he understands what we understand, which is that the Second World War and the myth around it is the justification for all types of horrible things. What do people talk about when they want to invade, you know, any travesty? You know, you want to kill a million Iraqis for no reason for Israel? Compare Saddam to Hitler. You want to commit white genocide and replace your native population with all types of other people without their permission? Call them Hitler if they resist. You know, invoke the Nazis every time. So some Jew wants to do an evil thing, or some plutocrat wants to do an evil thing, they always invoke the myth of the Second World War. And Peter Hitchens appears to understand this. Mm. And the book is very apologetic, like all conservatives, right? Like, he's very apologetic as he writes. He's like, oh, I don't mean to be insulting to all the people that suffered in the Second World War, but. And that but is the, you know, basically what he says is that the World War II fiction, the World War II narrative is actually more powerful in the Western modern neoliberal psyche than anything Christian or anything. You know, the image of Jews being put in gas chambers has replaced Christ on the cross. Right.
Right.
So that's exactly basically the point he's making here. And this book, you know, this is probably one of the foremost intellectuals in Great Britain. He wrote this very controversial book, and there's hardly anyone engaging with it. And this came out, you know, last August.
Well, okay? I will say in his defense there, you know, to adding that but as the operant term there, I think it's important because that would have reached out to people like me who, at the very beginning of my, you know, reconsideration of politics and political ideology, would have needed that sort of caveat to be established before I would hear you out. Because to me, you know, I was sort of taken aback by the whole narrative of World War II. I think, you know, most saliently put by Churchill, where he gave his overwhelming thanks and didn't really do much else but lip service to the Greeks, where he said, you know, the Greeks don't fight like heroes fight like Greeks. And, you know, I took that personally, like as you know, something that was a great honor to my people.
Right. The problem with pride in that,
whereas he let his whole country still to this day occupy Cyprus in what's now left to be a divided country, thanks to his continued occupation and the subsequent UN intervention into that country, where, you know, we have Greeks living in a divided country, in no small part thanks to the British presence on the island and their, you know, neutrality in terms of here comes Turks invading a fellow allied country, and they're going to just occupy and settle the north half of this island now.
Well,
and Britain's not going to do anything.
In the case of Greece in World War II, the British are quite a few historians in Greece have asserted that the British probably assassinated Metaxas, who was the prime minister of Greece during the Greco-Italian War.
So I've read a lot about the British involvement in Greece in the war, and I've never heard this before.
Yes, so
you'll have to enlighten me on that.
I'll enlighten you real quick. So when Italy invaded Greece, it was over there's two dominant forces in Greece at the time. One was the king, who was an Anglophile, and the other was Metaxas, who was the prime minister, who was actually a national socialist.
Anyone
that says Metaxas was a pro-Hitler, there are pictures of the leader of Greece, Metaxas, with Joseph Goebbels, and he was a Germanophile and he was pro-Hitler. So the Greek prime minister, the man they credit with fighting fascism, was literally a Nazi. So anyway, so Italy, so but behind Metaxas's back, the Greek king on the Mediterranean islands Greek owns, Italy was being attacked by the British because they were allowed to refuel their ships on Greek islands.
I've been to these places. I've met the people who lived on these islands occupied, you know, for the entirety of the period by the Italians, and I've heard this story before.
So the king was basically doing this behind the scenes, probably for money, and he was allowing the British to refuel their ships. And of course, the Italians were fighting the British in the Mediterranean with their navy. And the Italians were actually doing, you know, people always talk about how Italy is so shitty in World War II. The Italians fought very well with their navy in the Mediterranean, considering the odds. The British have had the world's most powerful navy at the time, and the Italians were actually very successful in holding them off for a while. But this problem of Greece allowing them entry and giving them sanction and so on, you know, was a problem. So Mussolini pulled the trigger and invaded Greece, and the Italians were defeated, or basically they were fought to a stalemate. But you know, that part of World War II, that was not considered, that conflict between Greece and Italy was not considered part of World War II. Greece and Germany were not at war.
It was only a small war. Later German intervention after the Yugoslav invasion.
So what happened was that, the Italians were basically, Hitler was basically disappointed in Italy and didn't want anything. That invasion of Greece happened without Hitler's permission, and he didn't want anything to do with that. And he saw it as a distraction from his general war plan. So there was actually contact between von Canaris, that was the German diplomat, and Metaxas. And the agreement was that Italy would actually cede territory to Greece, give them Epiros, I think, in Albania.
Right.
The Nazis were willing to get the Italians to give them Epiros, and so Greece would have literally gained territory from this conflict in exchange for a peace agreement. But get this,
we should have gone with it.
Get this, right? When this was happening, the British caught wind of it in 1941, January 1941. That's when they made contact with Metaxas. Then Metaxas died.
Right.
He died.
That was a very tragic and untimely death. And you think it was the British who assassinated him. How would they have gone about that? That's my biggest curiosity.
So the claim I've seen from people is that that Metaxas was sick. They think he was poisoned by the British.
Really?
And then when they went to the hospital, he apparently survived the poisoning. And then people said that the British were nearby, and they actually disembarked their ships to offer medical help to save Metaxas's life. And apparently the Greek king was in the know on this. Like, he knew this, they were going to do this, and he let them. And then when they went in, then Metaxas was pronounced dead soon after. So that is the claim I've seen. That's actually a claim that's popular with some circles in Greek historian circles that I've talked to. Basically, it was very curious, because it was as soon as Greece was about to sign a peace treaty. Because remember,
right. It was right at the worst time. I mean, any historian of Greece in this period will tell you, like, it was the most inconvenient point for which Metaxas to pass away.
Right.
And
then when
the
Metaxas
fact that he
died,
did, it was just it came with the worst outcome.
Well, when Metaxas died, they replaced him with a British puppet. And
exactly.
The first thing that guy – so the Greeks are winning the war against Italy. And the first thing the British puppet does, he lets the British come on to Greece, into Greek territory, which immediately – right? I mean, if the British are invading Europe through Greece, immediately that triggered the German invasion. And that was when World War II started for Greece. Mm-hmm. It wasn't under Metaxas. Okay, it was when the British came. So the Greeks were winning. They were about to win land and stay out of the war, retain neutrality. Metaxas mm-hmm. dies. A British puppet is appointed. And the mm-hmm. British they come into Greece, which forces the Germans to fight them back. And you know what's funny, too, is that Churchill in his diaries actually admits that he knew that the British expeditionary force in Greece was going to trigger a German invasion. But he wanted that. That way he could overextend the Germans so that they could, you know, maneuver around them, basically to take up their resources and manpower with stupid shit like invading Greece, because they had to do it, you know, because the British were constantly poking and prodding on the margins, and they finally succeeded. So, yeah, that's a very interesting history. And you know, anyone that says that Metaxas was an anti-fascist hero, I mean, you know, does that make Mussolini an anti-fascist for fighting him? You know?
Yeah.
Because he was a fascist too.
I mean, I tell people I'm an ML. And, you know, I do that tongue-in-cheek, knowing that that means Marxist-Leninist. But really, in my mind, that means Metaxist Legionarist.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the fourth, I mean, I think it was called the 5th of August, 4th of August government.
Yes,
it was modeled after the Third Reich, so, like, you know, all that shit is ridiculous. Like, any of the factors. I mean, Churchill and Stalin were true villains, and FDR was another fucking villain. Okay, yeah. All these people were true comic book tier villains. And that's basically what Peter Hitchens is arguing. He doesn't go that far, but he does argue, like, you know, the fact that there's a statue to Bomber Harris in the middle of London. Bomber Harris was the man that killed 200,000 women and children in Dresden.
Oh, yeah. That's
right.
So if you have to, you know, listen, if you feel, let's say in an alternate dimension, you feel that was necessary, do you really need to build a statue to the man in the middle of London?
No.
Is that something to be proud of?
Don't some German Antifa go around with signs that say, like, thank you, Bomber Harris, or something?
Yeah, usually it's around this time. I think it was last week. They do these parades where they celebrate Dresden, the massacre of Dresden. They literally go out and they have celebrations, and it says thank you, Bomber Harrison. They hold Israeli flags, and
yeah,
those are the Antifa in Germany, and those people have become very influential on American Antifa, because a lot of Jews in America, a lot of radical left Antifa Jews, go back and forth from Germany to America. And those people, like, basically are like the avant-garde of Antifa in Germany. And so, I mean, yeah, every year they have a celebration of Bomber Harris. They hold American and British flags and the Antifa flags together.
Look, the way I see it, I'm not happy for the suffering that went on to, you know, very recent ancestors, like your still living ancestors that had to go through the occupation of the Axis occupation of Greece and all the suffering that went on, you know, during that period.
There was a famine.
But you know, I'm not happy about the bombing of Dresden as a event that was, you know, in counter interest to that occupation either. Like, I'm not out here celebrating the death of civilians just because that same that same state, the army of that same state, was occupying the state of my people back in the day. You know, it was a war, and obviously, complicated by the British intervention.
Yeah, and the one thing when it comes to the famine, there's a really nasty famine where hundreds of thousands of Greeks died during World War II. And that famine was not caused by the Germans. It was caused by two factors. One, the British Navy in the chaos was blockading Greek ports so that food couldn't come in so that the Germans wouldn't be able to capture it. So they didn't want food going into Greece, and they starved them to death. This was like part of the British MO. I mean, they starved starved like 10 million Bengalis to death because they needed their food, so they stole it from them, and they all starved to death during the war. So the Bengali famine, the British loved to use famines as man-made famines as ways to punish their enemies or spur populations to rise up against.
And if you have any doubt about that, ask the Irish.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's like the starving women and children to death is a very is an old British tactic in war. The second is Hitler also made the mistake because he didn't see Greece as important. He put Bulgarians and other Balkan people, other Balkan allies in charge of occupying Greece. And as you know, there's like a lot of animosity between
the Crimean War wasn't that long ago at the time.
Right. There's a lot of animosity. So basically, like Hitler, during the British famine, Hitler tried to relieve the population of Greece. Mm. But some historians think that the Bulgarians that were in charge of the railways to bring the food to the Greeks were like going extra slow because they wanted to see Greeks suffer. So,
well, I wouldn't put it fucking past those.
But Hitler was actually Hitler was actually furious about it, though. Like, that's actually a known fact. Hitler was during the famine in Greece. He was actually enraged by it because he's.
I'll really have to do more research into this. You know, revisionist perspective on Greece, because
revisionist, like a lot of mainstream historians admit some of this stuff. They don't admit the British assassinated Metaxas, but if you even if you don't look at revisionist historians, you look at the circumstantial evidence, it adds up.
Okay.
Yeah. But
I will have to redo my homework on that one.
Yeah. But anyway, the point remains, though, is that the Second World War that myth needs to be destroyed.
Any
real political advancement. Yeah,
I agree. I think the whole thing that brought this up was my point that the explanation that Peter Hitchens provides there was like would be the first key step into somebody like me coming to where I am now, because I needed to get past that flattery that. You know, history remembers of Churchill talking about my people. It was flattery. And when I was a child, I was drawn in by that flattery. I gained pride from that flattery. And that's ultimately what it was, because it was flattery to cover for a more sinister history that existed, a more sinister timeline that occurred. And I think Americans also have the same flattery. You know, people who only identify with the American Allied soldiers in the conflict, who can only trace their ancestry to those people who stormed the beaches at Normandy. Yeah, they need to get over the flattery of the Allies in historical perspectives. They gave the sacrifice to this, but damn it, like, you need to look at the real facts of was it good for you or bad in the long run.
I'm in the unique position where both of my family members fought on both sides, so. It's like, I've always been kind of aware of just, you know, the anti-German sentiment. Because I consider myself kind of an Anglophile, but I'm also a Teutonophile. I'm not, you know, I'm, since those are both part of my heritage, I'm pulled towards both of them, and I kind of see through the bullshit, really.
Well, yeah. People have to be mature about it. Like, you know, you have to be able to look at the world and the facts and the history, yeah, like from a totally impersonal way. Yeah. The impersonal, yeah, but the impersonal objective thing to see here is that the Germans were the good guys. They were exactly. fighting for the whites. They were yep. fighting for the West. They were fighting for Plato. They were fighting for Beethoven. They were fighting for Da Vinci. That's who the Nazis were fighting for.
Yep.
Okay. Right. Churchill and FDR were fighting for Morgenthau. They were fighting for Rabbi Wise. They were fighting. That's who they were fighting for. Okay. That's who they were fighting for.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, whatever your grandparents may have suffered or
yeah.
endured during this time period, that does not take away from the objective reality that this was a conflict with a very clear good guy and a very clear bad guy. Yeah, it's not exactly. they teach you.
All right.
Yeah. Well, I actually have that perspective because no one on the American side really suffered too much, but my German grandmother. You know, she grew up, she was born in 45 and she grew up in the rubble. Her whole city was destroyed. Yeah. She had to walk to school in rubble. You know, it right. took years for her to be able to live in a normal society after my country, America, bombed where she, you know, grew up. And she lived in a war zone and it's sad. It always
probably
and,
like Syria is today.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if she were to tell her story, a lot of people, especially leftists and some conservatives, well, you deserve that.
Yeah, exactly.
You deserve to have your whole family killed because this was our good war. We were the moral ones. And when you invoke the name Hitler, when you invoke fascism or anti-fascism, you are allowed to commit any crime against anyone to stop them. That is the narrative. That's why this is so dangerous. That's why they always tap into it. That's why when they want to kill a million people in Iraq, they call them Hitler and the Nazis. That's why when they want to wall in the Palestinians, they say, well, it's to stop the fascists from rising up again. When they want to replace all whites everywhere in every Western country, they invoke national socialism yeah. as the reason to stop national socialism. So ultimately, whenever someone wants to take away your freedom, whenever someone wants to take your life, make you suffer, torture you without any due process. Whenever someone wants to do that, they just call you a Nazi or a fascist, and they're allowed to. It's yeah. seen thanks to this myth and this narrative. It's allowed. It's expected that when you put that label, when you pin that tail on someone, that you can do whatever you want, no matter how. That's why so many sadistic people like Jared Holt, so many sick-minded weird people that fantasize about beating up little kids and call, you know, this guy, Jared Holt, was saying in his high school post that he used to go up to like 13-year-old kids and say, everyone hates you. Get out of here. Everyone hates you. Don't, you know, people that feel that sadistic urge to hurt people, to inflict pain on people. They're attracted to anti-fascist politics yep. and anti-fascist jobs totally. Because it's the only profession where your serial killer, weirdo, sadistic feelings are allowed to come out in full force and nobody judges you. That needs wow. to end.
Yeah, no, totally agree there.
Well,
no kidding.
It's getting rather late. I have to wake up early yeah. tomorrow, but it's been a pleasure. It's been yeah. a pleasure, Stryker, and thank you for coming on. My name is Anglo. With me, I have Nike, and thank you for
yes,
listening, guys.
It's been a good time.
Yeah. Take care, everyone. Have a good night.
We'll be right back.